Well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation to come and speak. I've been to the Taggart Symposium before, but I think it's been a few years, probably since I was down here last time. So I want to really tailor my comments to what will be useful or helpful to all of you. So please feel free at any point. If you want to interrupt, ask a question, go down a different tangent, that's fine. I'm happy to do that and address the things that are going to be of most value to you. I wanted to start, though, and not presuppose anything on what the Division of Securities is. How many people feel like, I know Chuck already knows who we are, how many people feel like they already have a pretty good understanding of what the Division of Securities is and what we do? How many of you are our licensees? How many of you hold securities licenses? So probably at least half, a little more than half. So hopefully you know who we are if you have a license through our office. So, you know, we're part of the State Department of Commerce, securities licenses, all of the broker-dealer agents, and all of the investment advisor reps in the state, so Series 63, 65, 66. That all comes through our office. But really what we spend a lot of our time doing, frankly, is investigations and enforcement. That's where, you know, the rubber kind of meets the road, and that's where we're out there doing audits, responding to complaints, and I wanted to give you a little sense of sort of where I think things are in the arc of enforcement right now. And there definitely is, you know, a bit of a change, I think, that comes every time the economy dips and when we're doing well. There's really a cyclical nature, I think, to the business that we see in investigating fraud cases and other types of violations. So to give you a sense of where we're going to go, I'm going to cover some regulatory trends and talk about some significant enforcement cases that our office has done in the last year or two. Ken is going to get down into the weeds, going into labor, Department of Labor's new fiduciary rule, how that might impact your business if you deal with retirement accounts. And he's going to talk about robo-advice also and how we're dealing with that as whether or not a robot essentially can be a fiduciary and how that should work and how it'll look. And he's going to get into some of the technical changes that are going on in the marketplace right now. I wanted to give you a few charts, hopefully not to bore you too much at first, but to give you a sense of where I think things are right now in the cycle. So these are the number of complaints that we receive in our office each year. And so complaints are not complaints that, hey, Keith, you suck, or Ken's doing a really bad job, but complaints that there's wrongdoing, that there's some kind of violation of the Securities Act out there. Usually it's fraud. Yeah, this is for the state of Utah. So the first column is actually an average from fiscal year 2009 through fiscal year 2012. So this is in the depths of the recession. We saw a huge uptick in the number of complaints we were receiving. If I took this chart out even further, I mean, the long-term historical average is probably a little over 100. So we saw a real surge during those years where we were double the number of complaints that we would normally get. Since then, you can see it's definitely come down. Yeah, Chuck.
I'm just curious from your perspective. You know, some clients will always complain when they lose money and say, that's not what I need. So how many, from your all's perspective, I know FINRA's a little bit different, how many were justified?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, I think the best way to answer that is kind of compare the complaints to the number of enforcement actions we end up bringing. And I got that chart actually coming up. And so it's roughly about half, maybe a little less than half of those that end up in any type of enforcement action. So, you know, I think that's probably a good rule of thumb, is about 50% of them are probably valid complaints that end up in some kind of enforcement action by our office. So the trend is down, and there's no question that that's because there are fewer losses being suffered by people. And even if there's out-and-out Ponzi schemes that are going out there, it's pretty easy to keep your Ponzi scheme going and keep things covered up as long as the markets are good and there's money out there that you can get. It's when things collapse, like we had in 2009, 2010, and you can't get new money, that we really see a lot of schemes collapse. I'd also like to believe that, you know, it's because of us that we're doing a better job enforcing and deterring and educating. I'm not so naive to think that's really probably the biggest factor, but I do think that maybe there's some element of that. So new investigations, these are the actual number of new cases. So I guess, you know, with those complaint numbers, this gives you a sense of how many of those actually turn into an active investigation at the division. But part of that could be because we might get multiple complaints on the same firm, the same individual, that trickle down into the complaints. And you can see while it's a little noisier, there's also a downtrend and the number of investigations.
It seems that so far this year that there's been a large number of complaints in the newspaper going to court and such. And is that just kind of a holdover from last
year's
making it to court?
Yeah, like the Jeremy Johnson case has sucked up a lot of attention. D. Randall, Shane Baldwin, there's been some other Dutcher.
They're hitting all at the same time, and I just wondered if there was enough.
There's a huge lag in the time from when the complaints come in and the investigation happens till you see the criminal cases getting into the newspaper. So most of those cases really do date back into the recession that you're seeing come out in the newspaper right now with some of those high-profile prosecutions. Almost all of those, I think, really the conduct dates back to during the recession. So you can see the downtrend here in investigations as well. The flip side of that is the number of audits that we're doing. So this is when we go out to a licensed broker-dealer firm or a licensed investment advisor to do an audit. Because we've got more bandwidth, I mean, honestly, from 2009 through 2012, we didn't have the resources to do hardly any routine audits. We were completely reactive to the flood of complaints coming in. Now that that's dropped down some, we've been able to get back on a cycle where we're coming out. So if you hear from our office that, hey, we want to do an audit of your branch office, it doesn't necessarily mean we've gotten a complaint or that there's anything wrong. We're trying to get out to all those branch offices within like a 4 to 5 year cycle so that we're touching especially the investment advisors and to some extent the broker-dealer branch offices as well. So that number's been going up simply because I think we have the capacity to do more. And then you see it results in enforcement cases. You know, we average somewhere around, you know, 60 to 80 enforcement cases that we file. And that could be administrative, civil, or criminal cases that get filed by our office each year. Most of those are fraud cases, although it covers a lot of other types of violations, too, other than just fraud. The number of representatives, both broker-dealer agents and investment advisor reps that are licensed in the state, continues to go up. This has been a long-term trend. We saw a little bit of a dip during the recession, but not much of one, to be quite honest. And we're at all-time highs in both of those categories, both for BD agents and IA reps. The comparison I will draw, the rate of increase for IA reps is definitely higher than the rate of increase for new BD agents. If we're seeing a trend within the industry, it is that more people are going towards the investment advisor model than the broker-dealer model. And the number of firms that are getting licensed in the state, which I don't have the chart for up here, it's been pretty flat to actually a little bit down for broker-dealers. We're seeing a few broker-dealer firms actually drop out of the business and some consolidation within that space. The number of new IA firms, though, actually, we're getting a lot of applications for new IA firms. So we're seeing a lot of increase in that. So the IA reps are all state registered. So the firms might, if they're over $100 million in assets under management, they're SEC registered firm, but the reps all register on the state level. So that encompasses both people working at state-covered firms and Fed-covered firms. And I think where we're really seeing probably most of the growth is state-covered investment advisory firms. So these tend to be the smaller shops with, you know, one or two or maybe a small handful of reps working there. A lot of increase in that area. And we've seen a lot of people who are insurance licensed who are now then adding on to that insurance license an IA license so that they can give advice on, you know, a more holistic level, advise people about both their investments and their insurance needs without running afoul of any of the securities laws. That's definitely a growth area that we've noticed. So some of the trends I want to go through, really the types of scams that we see, it doesn't change a ton over time. The real estate related scams will never go away in the good times or bad times. I would say that's kind of the bread and butter. We see a lot of Ponzi schemes tied to real estate, whether it's fix and flip, whether it's real estate development projects, where there's promises maybe that there's some real estate collateral that's backing all this up. But in the end, what people are really getting are unsecured promissory notes. That's probably half of the cases that we deal with. And a lot of the ones that you see in the press are in some way Ponzi schemes tied back to real estate development deals. Yeah.
Speaking of which, though, I know a number of real estate agents who go out and solicit money to put together deals. Are they, because of Utah's laws, are they exempt?
They are not exempt. That's actually an issue we've been addressing here recently. We actually have a no action letter that's pending before office right now about that very issue, about to what extent can a real estate agent solicit in for an investment deal, and the answer is not at all, really, without being licensed.
I mean, previously, the previous head of the Realtors Association, going back to, I forget when it was, he was out of Sandy, he was head of the, do you recall who I'm talking about? And he passed a law freeing
up. Al Mansell, is that who you're talking about?
Mansell law freed up some.
Yes.
Green's bill, how did Green's bill, didn't his pass? And didn't that
so that's case? For the Mansell bill that passed several years ago really only covers tenant in common real estate deals. It's just for TICs. Okay. That there's a carve out where those in Utah, they're not treated as securities. So a real estate agent could solicit investment in a TIC without getting licensed. But for any other type of real estate connected deal, whether you're talking about REITs, whether you're talking about, you know, whatever that somebody's just putting together and they're raising money to develop a new project, those aren't exempt. So we've actually gotten that tightened down a little bit since that Mansell bill passed, to clearly define what it is. And honestly, the market for TICs right now, it's almost completely dried up. We see very few TIC offerings that are going on anymore, so it's not much of an exemption. They were very popular 10 years ago. We don't see a lot of TICs being sold in Utah anymore. There's a little bit of a, I guess it's fair to say there's probably a little bit of a resurgence in the last couple of years, and Representative Green was actually involved in some of that. But the scale of it compared to what it was in the early 2000s, I think there's no comparison. We had multi-billion dollar TIC deals that were being put together, and you just don't see that anymore. Now the ones you see, it's small. It's for, you know, an auto zone somewhere where, you know, they're going to put that into a TIC and sell off interests in a small commercial real estate piece of property. That's the kind of thing that we're seeing now. Not the huge ones that own all kinds of commercial real estate, huge office buildings, large apartment complexes. That's pretty rare to see those now. So those don't go away. And I mean, we can get into examples, and I've got a couple of examples I'm going to talk about. A couple of new ones that I do want to bring to your attention. Not that I'm concerned about, you know, anybody that's attending the Taggart Symposium running a scheme like this, but I want you to be aware of them because you may come across them. Your clients may come to you and say, hey, you know, so-and-so just told me I could make a ton of money doing this. And so I want you to be able to recognize those so that you know, okay, this is a common scam that's going around, and so that you can report them. And I'll at the end, I'm going to talk a little bit about our whistleblower law and why it could be even in your financial interest to report it to us. But the advanced fee schemes is an interesting one. So I'm talking here about, you know, they've been called prime bank schemes. There's often an international element to these, but at their basic level, what it is you're paying a little bit of money now to access a lot of money in a short period of time. It's kind of paying for your ticket to ride the rainbow, and then there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is how the story works. The common one that we've seen being used in the last couple of years is some story where there's a pot of money that's locked up in an account overseas. You know, it's in Europe or it's in Asia somewhere, and there are some regulatory reasons why the money can't easily be released into the United States. So we had this woman, Ann Delvecchio, who's now been prosecuted a couple of times and going for a third time that she's going to be criminally convicted, all on the same story, which is that she was this super-duper trader who had one of 12 licenses in the world that allowed her to do this special type of security trading. This is all made up. But that she had made billions of dollars because of her access to, you know, this special trading platform that she had. She's now retired, and her money is locked up. Her $5 billion is locked up in an account overseas. And in order to release it into the United States, she has to pay off Interpol and Homeland Security and maybe the IRS and some other people too. So you put in $50,000 to help her pay off these taxes, fees, bribes, whatever they are. That's going to unlock her $5 billion account, and then a month later, she'll pay you back $1 million for putting in 50, because what's $1 million to me? I got $5 billion sitting in the bank. I don't mind paying you $1 million. I just need some access to ready money right now. Now, you would think that alarm bells, right, would go off when you hear that, but it's amazing how charismatic and how convincing she was. She kept this story going for years.
Mostly older people?
No. She's older. She's now like 83. And she's 83. She has a glass eye. She uses a walker. And yet she is amazing how convincing she is with this story. And there are investors that, there, you know, I don't want to get too far into, and I certainly won't use any names, but we had some investors, victims in this case, who just would not believe that they were victims, even though we're investigating and telling them this is all bogus, there's no $5 billion account, who still were believers. And in fact, all through her first criminal trial, she was living with one of the victims who's coming to the trial, hearing all this evidence, but still believes, you know, that the $5 billion is going to be unlocked any day now. And everybody's going to get paid back, and it's going to be fine. So that's how convincing she is. So she's been convicted. She took it to trial, and the first one was convicted. There was another case. She pled guilty in that one. She's facing a third case now. But no judge wants to put her in prison because, you know, she's 83 years old. She's kind of sick. She's crippled. She's got a glass eye. She's a sympathetic character. But she's not going to stop raising money until she's put away. Yeah. So she raised about $15 million. Total. And that was over a few years. And I think there's been, you know, 70, 80 people that have given her money over those years. And she's, in fact, I just had a couple of investors come into my office this morning before he came down here to tell me they just learned about, she's up for another hearing in front of the judge to revoke her probation and send her to prison. She just solicited somebody else. I just found that out this morning. So it's that kind of scam. Now, that's an extreme example, but what I'm convinced of, because I've seen it enough times now, that when one person is successful with some kind of scam, word gets around, and you see copycats, other people doing the same thing. So we had another case that was similar in nature. Large account was locked up in Hong Kong. There was a value-added tax, was the story, that had to be paid, and it's being circulated through this bank in St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and you have to pay them some taxes as well. And then it was going to release this, you know, multi-billion dollar account. Actually, I think in that case it was only in the hundreds of millions, the account value. So I need some money now to pay these taxes, to pay fees, and it's going to release the account, and you're going to get paid back a huge amount of money. Same kind of story. Of course, you know, it's completely fictional. But this guy was pretty good. They had a lot of documentation. There was a guy you could talk to on the phone who claimed he was the banker in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Although if anybody would have looked him up, he doesn't exist. The bank that he says he works for doesn't exist. But at least there was some window dressing on it that made it look a little more plausible. So anything you hear like that, pay a little bit of money now so that you're going to release a big pot of money in some fashion. These are scams. It's always a scam. If you won the lottery in, you know, some foreign country that you don't remember entering, but you have to pay some money to get your winnings from that country, you didn't enter that lottery and you didn't win, and it's not real. That money is not coming to you, and yet we're seeing a lot of those advance fee schemes. The other one that's really trending right now, I think, is the idea of new technology startups. So we've had several guys who set up companies with some fantastic new widget, you know, whatever it is they've created. And then are selling early stage investment opportunities in that company. So you can get it on the ground floor before this thing goes public and you'll make a whole bunch of money when this technology revolutionizes the world. I could go through a lot of examples. I'll just maybe give one that I thought was maybe the most extreme. A guy who invented this nanonutrient water. You know, it was a closely guarded secret how he was making this nanonutrient water. But this water, if you drank it, would cure diabetes and cure cancer. If you fed it to livestock, the livestock grow like 3 or 4 times as fast and are more healthy. They never get sick. And better yet, if you put it in this box, this generator box, and hooked it up to your house, it would provide free energy to your home for, you know, up to a year on just one box of water. You also said you could put it in a diesel tank and it would run your diesel engine, this nanonutrient water. So it did amazing things, all kinds of stuff. But people will believe this. There are people who will believe this kind of stuff and who invested in his company, bought stock in a worthless shell company that he had set up based on this promise of this nanonutrient water. You know, and he had gotten some evidence. He had faked up some letters from Brazil where he claimed, you know, he was dominating the chicken market in Brazil. And they were feeding this nanonutrient water to all the chickens in Brazil and how much faster they were growing and how much healthier they were. But this was all faked. And he had studies, you know, that showed it cured cancer and whatever, also faked. So just be aware of that. If there's a new technology, if you hear somebody's doing cold fusion in the basement, you know, it's probably not true. Don't buy stock in that company. But if you hear about offers like that to your clients, we would really appreciate you reporting them to us so that we can get in on the ground floor on those scams. Yeah.
Keith, I get emails from time to time relating to GoFundMe.
Yeah.
You know, and you and I talked about the GoFundMe problems years ago, where that was going to go, and it seems to be used to bypass securities laws. If a client of ours is doing a GoFundMe, is it legitimate?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what they're offering in exchange. So if it's just a charitable contribution, nothing wrong with that. Certainly doesn't violate securities laws. If there's just, you know, they're raising money for whoever, you know.
They're raising money for a new product.
If it's for a product, you see some of those where it's a pre-purchase. So you're going to get, you know, whatever new computer it is they're building or whatever new technology. Also not a securities issue, and that's perfectly fine. If you're essentially pre-ordering and supporting this company. Where it crosses the line is if they're offering any kind of ownership interest in that company. So the crowdfunding and some of the sites like GoFundMe, Kickstarter, they're not doing equity crowdfunding. So they only do the charitable or the pre-purchase type of crowdfunding. And those are outside of the securities realm, perfectly legal. Well, I'm not going to say perfectly legal because we've seen some of them where there's consumer protection laws being violated because they're lying about, you know, what they're doing, or they're misusing the funds that they're collecting for a charitable purpose. And that's a separate issue outside of our office. But with the equity crowdfunding, when they're offering ownership, on the federal model, that's now legal. Okay, just went into effect this spring. So you'll see crowdfunding for ownership opportunities out there. They are legitimate now. The Jobs Act law that allowed the SEC to create the rules to put that in place is done. It took them 3-4 years to get those rules done, but they're done now and they are effective. Utah has not passed an intrastate equity crowdfunding law. Many other states have, but Utah has not. But it is legal here because it's under the federal model now that you can do this. There's a lot of restrictions. They're restricted on how much money they can raise, how much each investor can put in, what kind of disclosures have to be made, but it is legal. I personally think it's a really bad idea because most of these companies are going to fail, but it is legal. So that's out there. And if it's a donation-based or pre-purchase of a product, we don't even really get involved in those types of issues. So common violations that we're finding in our exams, and Ken can address this probably even better than me, but books and records almost always. You know, if you have a broker-dealer license, you have to keep books and records. It's amazing actually how many people don't actually keep very good books and records. Everything from your correspondence files to your complaint files, certainly any trading records, that kind of stuff. All of these records need to be maintained. You want to make sure that you're making your compliance officer happy by maintaining all those records, because anytime there's an audit, whether that's FINRA, whether it's us, whoever it is, the first thing they're going to ask for is all these files, all these records. And if you can't produce them, it's kind of a big red flag. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's something else going on, and often there isn't. And we almost never bring an action just for books and records violations. But it's kind of a precursor, right? It's like marijuana used to be. It's the gateway drug, right? If you can't keep your books and records, it just kind of makes us wonder, well, are they playing fast and loose with other rules? Not that it's a huge issue in and of itself, but it's indicative of who's running a compliance shop and who's not. We've had problems with reporting and supervision of outside business activities. So, it's, yeah. So same thing, it's either through the state or through the SEC, but there are still a host of rules on, it's the same kinds of records, you know, all the, every ADV that you've put together over the years and the signature that shows that you've given that to your client each year to update them on any changes to your disclosures, and frankly, even just updating that ADV anytime there's a change. We see some shops that just don't do that. They put together an ADV when they first went into business 8 years ago and they've never looked at it again since. Well, that's something you got to keep updated. And obviously, if you have custody, you know, keeping all of those financial records for any client funds that you've got custody over is a must. So it's just some of those simple things of keeping the records. And most of it's not illogical. I mean, these are things you would suspect that you have to keep records of. But having a good compliance person in place, having good working supervisory procedures in place and following those to keep a compliant shop is one of the things we're looking for right at the beginning. With the outside business activities, what's come up there is it's not something that the firm is doing, but they've got an agent who's running some kind of deal on the side. And so where the problem comes up for the firm is, all right, well, you may not have been involved in this scam that your agent was running and selling on the side to some of his clients, but was there anything there in reporting outside business activities that should have made you question or be aware of what this guy was doing? If he tells you he's got this outside business activity selling real estate investments, well, you need to ask some more questions about that and find out what that is. And is he selling away from your firm? Do you know about this? Is he selling to firm clients? It's just watching out for kind of rogue agents who may be branching off and doing something they shouldn't be doing under the guise of that firm. We've seen several people get into trouble with those. And I'm going to have an example here on the next slide. Unlicensed representatives, you know, the people who are customer facing, making solicitations, making suggestions, entering trades, those people need to be licensed. You can't have the unlicensed staff at a firm who are making the recommendations or doing the client facing business of affecting transactions or giving investment advice not be licensed. And with insurance agents in particular, we see that. We've got a couple of prominent cases we're working on right now where you got someone who's insurance licensed and they're selling an insurance product, but they're advising a client to sell or liquidate a securities portfolio in order to fund the purchase of that insurance product. Well, if you're providing advice on the decision to sell out of a securities product, you need to have a securities license. If you're getting paid for that, which assuming you're getting a commission for selling the insurance product, you are getting paid, we're going to look at both sides of that transaction. If you're recommending a sell over here and what you're recommending to sell is a security, you need to have a securities license to make that recommendation. So that's one area that we've really tried to focus on. And just the suitability of the investment, so I won't go into that one in detail. So areas of focus for us right now, alternative products and the sales practices used to sell those alternative products. So we're talking about annuities, REITs, other types of a little more complex and difficult products, not your vanilla type products, and knowing what's being used for advertising for those, the seminars. You know, is the firm looking at the advertising and seminar materials to see what this agent is really representing about the product that they're selling? And that's the area where we've probably seen the biggest problem with the unlicensed investment advice by insurance agents. When they're selling an equity indexed annuity, which of course you don't need a securities license to sell, but they're advising people to get out of the market and saying a lot about the suitability of being in the market in order to purchase that product. Affiliate relationships with credit unions, I don't know that that's a big one really for this audience, but that's been an area of focus of ours. It's these relationships that BDs have with credit unions, because the banks usually will set up their own subsidiary BD. And if they want to provide investment services, they have their own IA or their own BD that's under the bank, that's a wholly owned subsidiary. But with credit unions, you don't see that. Instead, you see an affiliate relationship where they partner with an IA or a BD firm to provide investment services to their credit union customers. But it's kind of who's driving the bus in that relationship. If it's marketed as services of the credit union, and the fees are going more so to the credit union than they are to the BD or the IA, the credit union needs to be licensed as a BD or an IA if they're really the ones that are driving the bus in that relationship. And that's an issue we've seen come up in the last year.
So let me ask for a practical example, because I grabbed a couple of these flyers from my credit union and yep. I'm going to send them to you.
We're well aware of those. We're actually in the final stages of working on several cases related to that.
Mountain America Credit Union offering $25 yeah. fee for if you go meet with and invest with LPL.
Right. So the issue is you've got a broker-dealer agent who's sitting in the credit union, but it's often being marketed, you know, and he's supervised by and employed by the broker-dealer firm, not by the credit union. But you're having a referral come from the teller or someone else at the credit union, hey, go sit down with this guy. And it's how they market it too. You know, are the materials to the customer are they marketed as Mountain America Credit Union, or are they marketed as, you know, LPL broker-dealer firm?
Do you need one of those flyers?
No. Trust me, we're all over that. Okay. Yes?
So then, I would go on that same situation. So since the teller is giving that referral to the financial advisor, does that teller needs to be...
Not necessarily for a referral. Not just to make a referral, you don't need to be licensed, but there is an issue about how they get compensated.
Okay.
So, like, if I'm the credit union employee and I refer you over to Ken, who's licensed through the broker-dealer but has an office in my credit union branch, and then if he closes the deal and he gets a commission of X, you know, from that sale, and then a percentage of that is being kicked back to me as the credit union employee, that's a problem. Because now I'm sharing in the securities compensation. But a flat fee, actually, there's a variety of no action letters and different things that say if a flat fee is paid, you know, I get $25 just for making that referral, that's okay. But I can't get a percentage of the business. Right, because that's securities compensation, and I can't take a percentage of it, if that makes sense. The credit union can pay me a flat fee just for making a referral, but they can't give me a piece of the business, essentially, on the security side. And a couple of things we're pushing for, in cases that we're enforcing, we're pushing more for admissions rather than allowing neither admit nor deny language now. We're also doing some things to try to collect our fines a little better. If we give someone the benefit of the doubt and let them neither admit nor deny, but then they don't pay the fine, we can include language to automatically convert it to an admission and convert it into a judgment. Not something, hopefully, that anybody here will have to deal with. All right, last thing I wanted to cover is just a couple of significant enforcement cases that we've had in the last year. D. Randall is one you guys may be familiar with because he had a very large insurance operation as well, which was a legitimate insurance company. But on the side, he was running a Ponzi scheme with these unsecured promissory notes. So this was $70 million total, 700 investors over the course of a decade or so. He just pled guilty to 4 securities fraud counts. And a pattern of unlawful activity. He's going to be sentenced next February. The reason for the delay is he's trying to come up with as much money as he can in the meantime to pay as much restitution as possible to see how that might impact his prison sentence going forward. The interesting thing I think to bring up in this group is the way he operated was he had the large insurance company, and then he had this, you know, small army of insurance agents that worked for him who had their clients out there for insurance purposes. But they were selling very expensive whole life policies to clients that really the clients couldn't quite afford the premiums on. And the way this was marketed, they called it a LEAP program, where you're selling a large whole life policy and then telling the client, yeah, look, I understand that you can't really afford the premiums on that, but you're going to make this side investment where you're going to get this promissory note from D. Randall that's linked to either a real estate deal or a subprime auto lending deal that he had, that pays such a high rate of interest that the payments on that promissory note are going to pay your premiums. So you put this money into the side investment and you're purchasing this large whole life policy, and the investment will generate enough income to pay off all your premiums on the whole life policy. But these people were in a position where if it didn't generate the income to pay the premiums on the whole life policy, they didn't have other assets to pay the premiums on this policy. So they're sold either through the agent or through D, this unsecured promissory note backed by, a lot of them he claimed were backed by these subprime auto loans, others were backed by real estate. It was all a Ponzi scheme. He was stealing most of that money and kind of shuffling the money around. But they didn't get, well, he paid interest for a while, and this thing collapsed here just a few years ago. And then once they stop getting their interest payments, they can't pay the premiums on their insurance policy anymore, and they lose that as well. So it's pretty devastating impact to a lot of these people. Lost not only their money they invested, but lost the benefit of that insurance policy that they would have had otherwise. So against a lot of those insurance agents, there's only one where we brought a criminal action where it's pretty clear that he was a little more heavily involved than some of the others. But most of the agents, it was administrative actions if they agreed to disgorge the commissions that they earned, because they were getting huge commissions from D for referring these clients over to him. If they disgorged that money to the trustee to get it paid back to the individuals, most of them were barred from the securities industry, but we agreed not to bring criminal actions against most of them. So that one was one where there was a legitimate insurance side, but it crossed over with a Ponzi scheme that was being operated on the side, bringing in $70 million over several years.
Two questions. Number one, you just mentioned the insurance agents were barred from the securities industry, and the association of NAIC, National Association of Insurance Commissioners, is going to be promoting a law saying if you lose your securities license, you're going to lose your insurance license. Do you see that coming out anytime soon on that model regulation?
I'm not sure about when or if the regulation is going to come out, but we're already working with the insurance department so that when we take an action that does bar someone for fraud, we notify the insurance department immediately. They generally put that, they flag the license of that person, and then when they come up for renewal, they probably won't renew them, is the way that it's working right now. So,
because they were doing that before, but not very effectively.
Not as effectively. I think it's getting a little better. The coordination between our offices has gotten better. And, you know, we've made the case that, look, if we're barring somebody because of fraud that they've committed, probably not a person you want to license either. And that coordination level is working both ways now, where effectively, if you get a securities bar, it's probably going to amount to an insurance bar as well.
Now, the second one pertains to LEAP. You mentioned the LEAP program, which is problematic in itself, that the insurance advisors that are trained signed a confidentiality agreement. But I've spoken with one who's talked about it. And basically, you get in even without a securities license, and you're advising on people's securities and returns
right.
and so forth. And do you foresee going
It's the same problem that, you know, assuming that there's not a Ponzi scheme attached to that LEAP program, which was the case here, it's the same issue of are you really providing securities advice to liquidate a securities product or to invest in some other securities product in order to fund an insurance product? And if we can put that together where it is clear that you're providing securities advice in connection with the sale of an insurance product, you've got to have a securities license. And Utah actually kind of leads the way there. We've got a very clear administrative rule put together by us and the insurance department that outlines that, that if you're advising someone to liquidate their securities to buy this insurance product, you're going to have to be licensed. Now, nobody's going to go to jail over that, obviously, and you're not even probably going to lose your license over that. But we are going to come and take a hard look at it and say, you just can't do this, and you're going to have to disgorge any commissions you got, and you're going to have to get licensed if you want to move forward in that capacity. Shane Baldwin, I'm taking up too much of Ken's time already. Let me end with this one. This one is a little different. So he was a recidivist. We'd actually taken a criminal action against him all the way back in, I think, 2008. It was a small action where it's just two investors and a couple $100,000, and he got a plea in abeyance, so he didn't go to jail, and he paid the money back to the investors, but then he ran a much bigger Ponzi scheme immediately on the heels of that. So his story was with Silverleaf Financial. I don't know if any of you saw that one in the news here recently, but essentially he claimed he was a fix and flip guru, but not for residential properties. These were commercial properties. He would take the FDIC assets that they would seize from a failed bank or a failed credit union, so their portfolio of bad loans, and he would buy up those bad loans on the cheap and then try to rehabilitate that property. So if it's a strip mall or, you know, whatever it is, or some commercial property, these weren't residential. He was doing only commercial properties. I think he had one that was a golf course, you know, anything. And then he could rehabilitate that property, get some tenants in, get it sold for much more than what he paid the FDIC for it. And look, he was a slick salesman. You know, he had some very nice promotional materials, very wealthy clients for the most part. This was not a mom and pop operation. So for that $30 million, I think really he only had, there were only 20 or so investors. So, I mean, most people were putting in over $1 million into this. Very wealthy clients. Very slick. His sales presentation was very nice. But in the end, what was he doing? He was reselling the same property to four different people, telling all of them that they had a first position trust deed on this property, which they didn't. In the end, his company, one of his other companies, would have the first position on all these properties. And he was selling the same assets to people over and over, operating the Ponzi scheme. Great result there. He just pled guilty here a couple of months ago, and he was sentenced to 4 to 30 years. In prison, mostly because it was his second go-around, and he had clearly not stopped. As soon as he got the plea in abeyance the first time, he started running a new scam. So in Utah, the way our criminal sentences work, it's an indeterminate sentence. So like for a second-degree felony, you get 1 to 15 years. For a third-degree felony, you get 0 to 5 years. And so you're committed to prison by the judge, but then it's actually up to the Board of Pardons and Parole to determine how much of that you serve. And they have a scale that they use that, you know, do you have a previous record? Some of it's even how well you behave while you're in prison. How much restitution have you been able to pay? A variety of other factors they look at. So it's really an indeterminate sentence. In his case, with that 4 to 30, he'll probably do at least 10, would be my estimate, which, frankly, I think is quite fair. He has no ability to repay these people. That money's all completely gone, and this is his second go-around, and it was far worse than the first time. And we're in that same boat. And that's a constant education process we're doing with judges where they don't always view white-collar crimes as egregious as violent crimes, which, okay, I get that. And that's certainly true if you're talking about rape, murder, this kind of stuff. No question. It's terrible, and people deserve serious sentences. But the truth of the matter is I think in a lot of instances you could hold up the 7-Eleven. You're not going to shoot anybody, but just because you have a gun, you hold up the 7-Eleven and steal a couple hundred dollars, you're going to go to prison. But you can run some kind of financial scam like Shane Baldwin did the first time around and get $250,000, and you're probably not going to prison. If this is your first offense, you're not going to go to prison for that the first time around. So there is some, education certainly to be done there. Last thing I wanted to say is just the whistleblower law. If you're not aware of it, Utah is one of only two states that has a securities whistleblower statute, which means if you report something to us that you suspect is a violation of securities laws, and we bring a successful enforcement action, you can get up to 30% of everything that we recover in that action. The only threshold is we have to collect at least $50,000, but that can be either administrative fines, criminal penalties, anything that we collect. If we get to $50,000 and you provided meaningful assistance in that case. So I'll give you one example. The first award in 2014, guy was a licensed investment advisor. He was part of the Southern Utah State Planning Council. At one of their meetings, our investor education coordinator was given a presentation. He came up on elder abuse was the topic. He came up at the end and said, hey, I think what you're describing just happened to a woman that I know. He's like, this is a client of mine. I was just looking at her finances. It was only the week before. And there was an unexplained transfer of $100,000 to this guy. And when I asked her about it, she couldn't give me a real good description of what it was for. She said it was an investment, that he had this business he was running and it was going to make her a lot of money, but she really didn't understand what it was, and it sounded very fishy to me. And that's really all he had to go on, was that tip. But he got the information from her, told us the names, who she was, who she transferred the money to, and here's the bank where the transfer took place. We subpoenaed the bank records, found out this guy, within 30 days of that $100,000 hitting his account, he had spent it all for personal uses. Okay, well, that's clear. It was actually in St. George.
Oh,
it's actually down in St. George.
It sounds like a thing that happened to a guy in Provo, Hines.
Oh, the Stephen Hines case? Yeah. Similar kind of deal with Stephen Hines, yeah. This is a different case. The guy's name was Loveday. Richard Loveday was the perpetrator. So anyway, within 2 months, we had a criminal action filed. We caught it early enough that actually there were still assets. He paid back the $100,000 to this woman. He was a Canadian citizen who was actually wanted in Canada for some other stuff that he had done. So he pled guilty, paid the $100,000. He was deported to Canada, where he was immediately arrested by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to face other charges. And this advisor, who did nothing more than kind of come up and tell us that, hey, this is something you ought to look at, got $15,000 for just, handing us that case. So that's what we're talking about here, potential awards. So it's in your interest to pass on to us suspicious information that you have, even if you don't have a whole lot to go on. We'll still take that. We're more than happy to look at that, because you guys will find out about new scams before we will. It doesn't come to us until after the money's gone and there's blood on the floor and people are upset and they've tried everything else they could to get their money, and then they go to the state. You guys are going to hear it from clients way before that, when they're still thinking about it. And I know you give them good advice and tell them, hey, you might want to think twice about that. That sounds a little fishy, and that's great. I appreciate you doing that. But take the other step of finding out what you can about it and passing it on to our office. And frankly, it may inure to your benefit to do that. All right, with that, I'm going to pass it off to Ken.
It's a purple sheet. It's not the yellow sheet. Good afternoon. It's great to be here. My name's Ken Barton. I'm the Compliance Section Director. Keith is my boss. From Compliance Section Director, what that basically means is that I'm your friendly neighborhood regulator that does all of the examinations if there's a complaint on you, and as well, we'll go out and do routine audits. So my presentation today, and I'm going to cut it short a little bit to make sure that you can get to your next item, but how many people are aware of the DOL fiduciary rule? And how much information have you been getting from your firms on it? Are you getting stuff daily, weekly, monthly, little hourly? Yeah, so some firms are a little bit more ahead of the curve than other firms. You know, the thing that's difficult with this is how much time you want to go ahead and spend is difficult, in part because of this item right here, and that is that things still are a little bit in flux. And they're still trying to figure things out. And so how much you're going to need to invest, clearly you want to start paying attention to the rules and start preparing. It's going to be much better that you're prepared for the rules if they do eventually come to fruition, as opposed to being caught unawares. But main thing, why the IRS, why the Treasury Department, why the Department of Labor? Well, it really comes right down to the fact that these are dealing with retirement accounts, and if you think of retirement accounts, they're generally started out as employer-sponsored accounts, as well they're tax-advantaged accounts. So it was the IRS that would levy penalties for overcontributions or distributions that were made. Maybe they didn't do a required minimum distribution, those kind of things, all policed and penalized by the IRS. So that's the reason why the DOL rules are all going to be enforced by Treasury and not by us. But it's important for us because we do think that there's a high probability that the SEC would like to eventually come up with its own fiduciary rules. A couple things just about the timeline. One thing is that it really is about 6 years in the making. A couple things that you'll want to really understand is that the effective date was this year, and this date's an important date, April 10th of 2017. By that time, you really need to be in a situation where bottom line is you should be trying to follow the rules, because as of that date, you're kind of being held accountable for applying the rules, and they can go back after the fact if you've broken a rule. But really, the end of the transitionary period, at least right now, is January 1st of 2018. So these do have a tendency to actually not be rolled out as quickly as sometimes they think. Next item is kind of why were they doing this? And when it really comes down to it, I can say it in a sentence. It's really all about the shortfall of retirement savings. And this is really the opportunity to kind of put the time value of money equation and include a factor like fees, and the fact that if you take so much money out in fees over a long period of time, you see that the end amount of the retirement savings when you get to the point where you want to begin taking distributions is much smaller, because all along fees have been taken out. So you're not earning money, and you're not getting the benefits of compounding. There's demographic issues as well, and then quite frankly, there are political issues. It's a lot easier to do this and reduce how much you're going to be able to collect in fees than to try and increase the amount of a Social Security benefit. Yeah.
Political purpose was getting rid of the arbitration.
Okay, I appreciate that. And if we could put the questions to the end, if you could do me a favor and do that, because right now there's no way we're going to get through this in 10 minutes. So just to run through it real quick, and just to give you a high-level piece, I mean, pre-DOL is really a situation where this is A definition of a fiduciary is who did what and were you compensated. Now the new is if you're providing advice and if you're compensated, then you fall under the DOL's fiduciary rule. With regards to making a definition about what a recommendation is, because I think that that's, you know, one of the things that some of these terms all come with definitions. So what's advice? What's recommendations? In the recommendation standpoint, you're going to see it's really broadly defined. If you really talk at all about investments, it's a recommendation, whether it's a securities, whether it's non-securities. If you're helping them determine different kinds of asset allocation methods or investment strategies, that's a recommendation. If you make a recommendation to even have them take the money from their retirement plan and put it into a rollover IRA, that's what they've deemed to be a covered recommendation. All of these are going to be covered under the rules. In defining advice, again, it gets back to if you're providing advice on any coverage recommendation, and really what it comes down to is if you're helping somebody, if you're talking to them about doing something that is related to one of those recommendations, you're providing advice. And in the past, there kind of used to be this situation where there needed to be a little bit of an understanding, you know, kind of a mutual understanding that I'm providing you with advice and they understand that they're receiving advice. It's assumed if you're talking about these things that you're providing advice and you're going to be held responsible to the fiduciary standard, which is the best interest of the customer standard. So, and the other important thing is that doesn't have to be a one-time thing. So broker-dealers used to, you know, maybe a one-time recommendations, buy a stock, sell a stock, investment advisors, asset under management over a long period of time, doesn't matter. Under the Department of Labor rules, if you do it once or if you do it multiple times, you all have to apply to the best interest of the contract or best interest of the customer fiduciary responsibility. Education, this is another big piece in defining education. And basically what I would say is pretty much every single seminar that I see advertised would not fall under the new rules very well because you can't reference any investment product. Really, it's a situation where you can talk about how much they can have as far as contribution limits and how they can get money out of their plan, basic information about diversification, calculators to help you determine how much you can take out, how much you might have at the end if you have a certain rate of return. Those kind of things are all education. But when you take out all of the reference to any investment product, you can no longer call this an educational seminar. Make sense to everybody? Good. So when it comes down to real kind of practical considerations, you know, the fact is that, you know, the train has kind of left the station. From an optics standpoint, the SEC really looks at it and says, we're going to have to get on board. And a big part of it is just the idea that it's really difficult to say now that Wall Street would be on the side of not recommending that there is a best interest in the customer standard. That's kind of a losing argument. Politically, it's a losing argument kind of in the public domain. And what they found is that a lot of people already, a lot of your customers already think that you're operating under the standard, whether you actually are required to or not from a regulatory standpoint. I'm going to cover digital advice, and I'm going to go through this really pretty quickly. But it's definitely a change that's coming. We see it coming. Another situation where really market forces are going to change the way we do business, just like it did in the 1990s, where it kind of started out. If you look on the left-hand side of that slide, you see that, you know, we started out kind of a business-to-business commerce, and, you know, generally then you started using it as a distribution for channel for sales. And then you would create a, you know, kind of the idea that this is the way we just do business. Well, that really has flipped. And now you look on this side where you know, digital identity is kind of the all the rage. You want to be on social media. You want to have people following you on Twitter. You want to have an avatar, you know, that maybe has a more rich social life than you actually have yourself. But that's kind of what the idea of the evolution of, you know, digital commerce really is. So we know it's happening. We also know that it's not just including millennials. A lot of people think that only millennials are interested in this. Time after time, actually, it seems to indicate that baby boomers who have earned a lot of money, if you think about the baby boomers who have earned money in Intel and Apple, they've learned the advantage of technology and being able to leverage technology in their investments. So a lot of times, while there might not be as early of adopters, they're not going to want the most cool iPhone out there that, you know, has a super duper camera on it. But they know how important technology is, and they want to be a part of this. So as a result, you really see a situation where, you know, kind of the estimated assets under management is going to grow. Really, with this slide, whether it's through strategic partnerships, whether it's through mergers and acquisitions, or whether people end up just building their own infrastructure in-house, the fact is that companies are going to have digital offerings. That's just going to be the bottom line. It'll be the way it'll work. This is the regulatory issues. And really, the regulatory issues, I'm going to lump them together. I kind of had the slides split out, SEC and FINRA, but really when it comes right down to it, both the SEC and FINRA has the same concerns. And those concerns really are, is, as Keith kind of mentioned, you know, how do we hold a robot, you know, to a fiduciary standard? And, you know, it's been questioned so much that even one of the SEC commissioners has indicated that, you know, what's that going to look like and can they even do it? And in particular, even when they kind of put it side by side with the fiduciary rule that we just mentioned, so now we've got a fiduciary rule and now we've got kind of this robo-advice, and when we look at those two things, it seems like it makes it even harder for us to be able to meet that fiduciary standard using digital advice. So, and you know, it's really asking the same questions. How do we know that the advice is going to be free from conflicts of interest? And how do we know that it's acting in the best interest? You know, the algorithm is acting in the best interest of the client. So this is an important slide for nothing other than this black box. I will tell you, regulators hate black boxes. We're not real big on the Rumpelstiltskin type, you know, we're going to have straw on this side, we're going to put it through this black box, and we're going to have gold come out on that side. It's one of those things that the black box in particular has a problem, and it immediately bounces up against one of the critical and most important things that we have in the regulatory industry, and that is that somebody that's going to be an investor needs to understand and needs to at least know what they're investing in. And that knowing piece is disclosures. How do you have disclosures when you don't have transparency? And that's really the question that both the SEC and FINRA has decided that it's going to be pretty tough for us to be able to answer those questions. And incidentally, now FINRA does require algorithms to actually register as an investment advisor. So another concern that FINRA has, and they did this, is actually part of a notice to members that they sent out. But the interesting thing here is, you know, they're looking at this all for a 27-year-old person, and you can see one person is recommending a 51% in equities, and this one, this digital advisor over here, is 90%. What kind of variability is that? I mean, a difference of 40%, and yet you're looking at the same customer. So real questions about how important investor profiling is, how you ask the questions, how you gather the information, how you update the information on an ongoing basis, all of those things raise questions about how well digital advice is going to be able to work. Other questions that they have is that everybody knows probably in this room that there's a certain amount of science to what we do. But there's also a certain amount of art to what we do. And what computers do really well is the science side stuff. But the art side stuff, things that are a little bit more fuzzy, questions about how I need to set up things to pass stuff on to my heirs, those kind of things, not very easy for a computer to be able to make those kind of decisions on. So as a result, there's just a question on having this be, you know, kind of the be-all and an end-all. And when it really comes down to it, what we see as, you know, from a practical consideration, really it's going to come, but what we really look at is that more likely than anything else, the situation that we're going to end up running into is really that the robo-advice is going to be a percentage of a person's overall portfolio, probably just like other passive investments. A certain percentage is going to be in passive, non-active management stuff like robo-advice or like investing in products that are it's slipping my mind right now, but investing in straight the S&P 500 market. So indexed investing is the term that I'm thinking of. 1 minute. So we've got 1 minute left, and I'll just put our phone number up there. Happy to answer any questions that you have. You can always call us at that number. But we appreciate the fact that you guys are all getting together, that you're taking the time to learn more about your industry, and we hope that you have a great conference. Yes?
If we as advisors suspect something going on that is not appropriate,
mm-hmm.
we simply pick up the phone and call that number and say, I'd like to talk with someone about...
Yes.
Is that as simple as it is?
Absolutely. And the whistleblower issue that Keith talked about, that was an advisor that picked up the phone and called on behalf of their client. So we do...
There's a form to fill out.
You can pick up the phone. We might ask you to complete a form or send an email, provide us with more detail. The more information that we have, the more we can go in kind of in advance, knowing where the issues are, knowing where to look in the exam. All of that will help us, but it certainly can start with a phone call. And then, you know, we'll get you hooked up and get you talking to an examiner that can go out and will actually be the person that will be on, with the boots on the ground in the person's office. So, great. Thanks a lot. Enjoy the rest of your conference.